This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. An unlikely friendship begins in the Paramount Plus original movie, Little Wing, starring Brooklyn Prince with Kelly Riley and Brian Cox. Reeling from her parents' divorce, Caitlin steals a valuable bird to save her home, but instead forms a bond with the owner, leading to a new outlook on life. Little Wing, now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. Head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Rated PG-13.
Prisoners?
Hello, and welcome to Something About the Beatles 278, hot on the heels of 277, with Michael Medeiros. This one is with Patty Boyd, who I have long wanted to get on the show. She, of course, wrote her memoir back in 2007. If you have a UK copy like I do, it's called Wonderful Today. In America, it was called Wonderful Tonight, a little more literal after the song, but that's how it goes. And she has since published a book of photos, which came out, I think, last year, 2023. At least that's when I got my copy. And in any event, currently in the news for the Christie's auction of some personal possessions that she's been holding on to all these years that she's decided to relinquish. And we talk about that. And if you go online now, the auction closes fairly quickly. So if you're hearing this, go check it out. There'll be a link posted on the Sappy page if you want to see the stuff. But pretty amazing collection of things. There's some clothing, which, being a model, you would kind of expect her to have held on to. A couple of Fool designs, as well as personal correspondence. You guys may have seen the news reports showing some of the items. The love letters from George and from Eric. And a few odds and ends, like a letter from John in 1973. Some Apple tchotchkes, Apple Records stuff, and lots and lots of pictures. So that stuff's out there. There's also a video on YouTube she did for Christie's, sort of giving a little bit of backstory, but you get a lot more in-depth conversation here. We had an hour between the rounds and rounds of interviews she's been doing, and I tried to make the most of it. So I hope you're pretty satisfied. Maybe we'll talk again. We'll see if the fates permit, but I was able to cover as much ground as I could during this time, and Patty's all the Patty you want her to be. She's great. Check it out.
Meet Dom, the fabulous Pearl Eye shampoo from Paris. Dom. In four unique formulas with special beneficial action for greasy, dry, dandruff, or normal hair. Dom, the right shampoo for every kind of hair. Shampoo by L'Oreal.
In Vegas in 2008, when your book had come out and you were doing that tour, there was that group of women, first-generation fans, in the schoolgirl uniforms.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was really, I couldn't believe they'd gone to all the trouble to do that.
I guess I wanted to lead with that question because, on the one hand, you can absolutely look at it as silly and what a thing to do and so much labor and stuff, but on the other hand, it speaks to the impact, the lifelong impact you made going back to the 60s when these were young, impressionable girls becoming women, and it stayed with them forever. So I guess my first question would be, back in the 60s and you became this public figure, did you have any awareness in real time of the impact that you were making on a generation of female fans in America?
No, I didn't. I mean, I think that's an impossible thing to do, to actually be aware that something important is happening. And really, that was the start of the big madness and the adulation of the Beatles. I had no idea that I would ever be seen again. You know, I just didn't. There's no reason why I should look that far ahead.
Right. And that's the thing that is amazing, because I've read your book, I've seen many an interview with you, And it's not like you had some grand design to be a celebrity or to be Twiggy or some kind of iconic figure. Yet, I've got a lot of people I've had on the show, ranging from first-generation fans to writers and Gen Z women. And when they found out that I was going to have a conversation with you, they were so excited. And the memories poured forth of when they would be looking at the fan magazines and seeing what you were wearing and trying to emulate it and all that stuff. And it's like, as a male, we regarded the women around the Beatles a certain way, but the women who looked to you as a role model, it was a very different thing and a very profound thing. And what is amazing to me, that it has stayed lifelong. And it seems like you couldn't have been that aware of it when it was happening, but have you had time as you meet people and go around the world and do talks and stuff to sort of get a sense of that? And how does it feel?
Yeah, I have. And to begin with, Robert, I felt very shy and I wanted to hide away from it. But, you know, I'm far more grown up now, obviously. And I just think, I don't know what it is. I mean, I think the Beatles in that period reminds everybody of how they were when they were young. What a glorious time they were having, you know, experiencing love for the first time, experiencing the best music. And, you know, so I think partly it's to do with their age and what they're experiencing. And then they put it on to me. So I don't know. I mean, part of me really doesn't understand at all that I never was desperate to be famous because I was rather shy. Mm-hmm. And I had no desire to be out there in the public. In the public eye. And when George and I got together, we got together because we liked each other so much. And it wasn't until afterwards that I realized that I'm going to have to share him. So many other people like him too, even though they don't know him. And I didn't think anything of myself. But suddenly now I'm in a position where I'm thrown out into the public view and I have to, you know, do something. And I don't know. I found it a bit of a struggle, but I managed to get through.
Yes, you got on with it.
I did.
I think somebody else in your shoes might have resented it.
Yeah. No, it was fine, you know. You're presented with a situation in life, and you have a choice. Get on with it or hide.
Right.
So I thought, I'm getting on with it. I'm not going to miss out on this trip.
Right. And you did describe pretty early on, I think maybe in the Hunter Davies book, that when you got thrown into the deep end right away, as it were, it was pretty ugly. You were being violently attacked.
Well, yeah, Robert, there was one situation where George said to me, come and hear the band playing at the Hammersmith Odeon in London and take some friends, and I will let you know when you should leave. That'll be before the last number, mm-hmm. so I could get out safely. So anyway, I knew when we should leave. I got up with my friends. We went out the nearest exit door and down this really dark kind of passageway. And all these girls followed me out and they were kicking me from behind and pulling my hair. And Terry Doran, who was with us, was sort of trying to protect me. And then he grabbed my hand and he said, come on, we're going to run. We ran all the way to the car with these girls running after us. It was actually pretty scary as well as unreal.
Sure.
I'd never come across anything like that before.
Yeah. Wow. That must have been terrifying in the moment. Now, your career started in modeling, and you started getting TV ads, the Smith Crisps ad that I think the fans know about.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think there was other, like, hair products or something, but the car wash one, right?
Yeah, the car wash. That was for a German shampoo called Dop, D-O-P, which I never saw anywhere. Never saw it in any store, any pharmacy, even, I mean, anywhere. So it probably was only sold in Germany, but it was great fun to do that. And it was live. I had to get into this Jaguar car, it was an E-Type, and go through, literally through that car wash, where it washed the car and I washed my hair. And like all filming, it doesn't work on just one take. I had to dry my hair again and then try again. We did it about 3 or 4 times.
Oh, geez. It's a great spot, and people can find it on YouTube, I believe. I've seen it before, so pretty amazing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's fun.
So was your agent then that got you steered to A Hard Day's Night? Now, when that came along, were you already a Beatle fan, or was that something that kind of coincided with getting to know them?
I don't know if I would describe myself as a Beatle fan. I liked their music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I liked listening to the Stones and the Beatles, and lots of wonderful music was coming out at that point in time. And in London, and all my friends, you know, we say, have you heard this record or that record? You know, so it was very much the new thing to listen to. The Beatles were the new thing we all have to listen to. So, you know, it was on that sort of level. I wasn't a mad fan, but I liked their music.
Was there anything you were a mad fan of at that time?
No.
Okay.
I was probably too involved in my modeling career.
Uh-huh.
You know, okay. I'd got so much to do. I was busy and I was trying to be thin all the time and not eat anything. And I was always so hungry. you know, so I had too much other stuff on my mind. And also I did work an awful lot, several times every week. So there's no time to be a fan, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, anyway.
So when that came your way, that you would appear in a motion picture involving the sensation of the day, do you remember how that felt and where you saw that going? Did you have any sort of anticipation for what would happen from it?
No, I didn't have any anticipation. I had no plans to further my career on the screen. I never wanted to be an actress. As I told you, I was a bit too shy, and the idea of acting and talking was like a bit too much for me to handle. I was quite happy with standing and not saying anything, wearing wonderful clothes. As in modeling, that was fine. That was easy to do. But no, I had no plans to further any sort of career like that. Plus, I never knew if I would see George again. Because once I turned him down and said I couldn't see him that night, I didn't think, oh, maybe I'll never see him again. It didn't occur to me because we didn't have mobile phones in those days. But Dick Lester, the director, must have had other plans for George and me because he called me and some of the other girls back for a press shoot about a week later. And so during that week, I don't like my boyfriend after all. You know, he's a bit dull, blah, blah, blah. And then I knew I was going to see George and this was terribly exciting. I thought, this is really exciting because now, at this point, I realized how famous they were, and God, to go out with him would be wonderful. I can tell my children, my grandchildren, and, you know, I just thought about it would just be one evening with him.
Yeah.
But there we were, going out, seeing each other for 2 years, and then we got married.
Mm-hmm. So it's funny, in the shoot you're describing, where you see they're sitting in the director chairs, and you're the one combing George's hair. Did you get assigned, or did you guys each select which Beatle you'd be working on?
Oh, Robert, I made a beeline. I went straight for George. There's no point, you know, in going for any of the others.
That's great. Now, you're putting up through the auction house these items that most people, it's amazing you held on to everything, that you held on to as much as you did. That kind of floors me, because this is ephemeral stuff that I would think, when you're caught up in that whirlwind, that it would just fall by the wayside and you've moved and all that, and yet here the stuff is. And a lot of people would look at this and go, this is amazing. These are treasures. Why now are you looking to unload them, as it were? And did you have any sort of expectation how you would like to see them end up, rather in private hands or in a museum or something like that? What did you think as you were entering into this world?
Well, first question was, why now? And a few people say, why now? I mean, I am not going to wait till I'm on my deathbed. I don't see the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I've been lucky enough. I've been the chosen one to look after and be the custodian of all these beautiful pieces of art, really, and letters and, you know, all sorts of lovely little trinkets. And I think I've enjoyed them and loved them so much for so long. It's now time for me to unload them and to share with other people. I'm not a museum. Maybe a museum would like some of the pieces, which would make sense. And also I want to share, you know, not everybody will have seen these lovely things I have.
Right, right. It is a truly amazing collection. I think one of the first impressions, as somebody who lives in Beetle World, and I've seen a ton of things, there were things I obviously had never seen before. One of the first things I was struck by was Eric's handwriting, which was amazing.
It's utterly beautiful. It's, you know, it's very, very, very artistic and really beautiful. I mean, I've got some letters from my great, 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 great grandfather in like 1870.
Wow.
And again, the handwriting was immaculate and beautiful, and with a pen and ink, just so, so beautiful. When people cared about how they were writing and what they were saying. And this writing is so full of emotion. You know, if you're a graphologist and you can read handwriting, you would be able to see that this is written with so much passion and intensity.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the as opposed to writing something on your iPad or your phone.
Right.
Which is blank. It's one-dimensional.
Handwriting is a lost art pretty much anymore because everybody types.
Well, I think, Robert, bring it back.
Yes. Have a place to go.
You could have a little thing on your show asking people to write something, you know, and test everybody's handwriting. Get a graphologist in.
Oh, I'd fail that test, but it'd be amazing.
Yeah, get a graphologist in to tell you a little bit about these people. It would be such fun.
It would be, absolutely. Writing's on the wall.
It's up to you to see.
Had you ever entertained the thought of maybe before letting it slip from your hands, putting together maybe like a picture book of some of the stuff that you had? You did the beautiful photography book that just came out in the last year or so. So I was thinking something along those lines.
Oh, Robert, that would have been so nice. You know, that would have been really nice. In fact, you've given me the most brilliant idea. I'm going to ask Christie's, who are the biggest auctioneers in the world, I'm going to ask them to ask their photographer to give me copies of everything they photographed. Then I could put it together as a book.
Absolutely. You could do it. You've got it in hand. You got those beautiful high-res pictures.
That is such a good idea of yours. Muchas gracias.
Yes. Banana. Your fans, your legions would love you for it. Absolutely.
And what is disappointing about the auction is that they're not doing a catalogue, and I thought that they would do.
Yeah.
And they said no. But then I can create my own, can't I?
Absolutely. And maybe even beyond what's for auction now, stuff that you have that you're not letting go of right now. You must have amazing things, because one of the things I was looking at in the listing, and I was thinking in terms of the female listeners of the show that would absolutely be dying to see what clothing you're putting up. And that would be a book unto itself. You know, whatever you've got still in your holdings of just fashion. In fact, one of the friends of mine who is a cartoonist by the name of Carol Tyler, had, when she found out you were coming on the show, she goes, can I draw her outfits? That would be great. So that's something out there. Just another thought sending your way.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. Good idea. Lovely.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, because I saw that a couple of things up there were by The Fool, designed by The Fool. What did you think of them? Can you describe that experience? Because there was a time, that period around Pepper, that they were very much in the Beatles' pockets and designing an album cover that didn't get used, but I guess they did the inner sleeve. And then, of course, they worked at the Apple Boutique, which your sister was co-managing, and did the mural on the building. Tell me what that was like for you.
This trio were most exciting. They sort of jumped into our lives from Amsterdam in Holland. And they were so full of creative energy. And they seemed to dance all the time. And they played little flutes. And they were quite, you know, they were sort of as if they jumped out of a book. They were utterly intriguing. And we were all fascinated by them. and they could design and they could make music. And we all fell in love with them. We thought they were the best. And of course, Apple had really sort of started, it's got into its swing, and they were looking for artists or musicians, and, you know, they wanted to work and be creative. And then when The Fool arrived, I mean, it just couldn't have been more perfect. So that's when, I don't know who it was, someone thought we should have a boutique, and then they can do all the clothes or manage or design the clothes. And
in hindsight, it didn't last long, and it seemed to be some fundamental problems in infrastructure. Were you disappointed that it didn't play out the way you guys envisioned at the start?
No, you know what? There was so much going on, so much.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
That it was almost a move on to the next thing so quickly.
Mm.
I mean, if you think about it, the Beatles didn't really stay together as a band that long compared to many other bands, you know, but we crammed a heck of a lot of things into a short space of time.
That is the thing I think that is most astonishing to people today, that the entire from Love Me Do to Let It Be was the period some people take between albums nowadays. It's staggering what they achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, they were so young. We were all really young, you know, in our 20s.
Yeah.
Can you imagine these guys, these four guys in their 20s, wooing the entire world with their creativity and their everything that they produced musically? I mean, it was astonishing.
And there's no blueprint for this. There's no precedent.
Quite.
You have no idea 50 years later, people are going to be still dissecting this stuff.
Do you know, I remember once George and I were at home and a journalist came to the door and he said very seriously, "Now, George, can you tell me when is the bubble going to burst?" And that was in 68.
It's still getting bigger and hasn't burst yet. So
I know. It's so funny. It's so funny, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He's probably long gone.
Oh, sure. Do you read any Beatle books? Have you?
No, but a friend of mine called Peter Brown, he's just writing a book. It should be out next month. You know, Peter Brown knew the Beatles very, very well right from the beginning. He was Brian Epstein's best friend. And Peter really knows the backstory to the Beatles. And his book is very interesting.
The Love You Make?
Yeah, it's a lot I didn't know, you know, what goes on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you specifically, I had on the show a month or so ago, Philip Norman, who indicated he has lunch with you a lot and obviously just did the George book. Did you read that one?
Yes.
Okay.
Why does he tell tales about us having lunch?
Well, that's what he does. Yeah. So
yeah, we have lunch. He's very amusing. Great fun.
Okay. So you were basically his star witness, it seems, for the book.
Yeah. I mean, I dipped in and out. I didn't read the whole thing, I have to admit. But what I did read, I like. I like the way he writes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you saw enough of it to be satisfied with it and didn't feel like, oh, that's not what I meant, or he's not getting that right?
No, I didn't feel that. But I mean, Robert, to be honest, I didn't read it from cover to cover.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Neither did I, truth be told.
You know, I mean, I dipped in. It's nice to do that and just read the chunk here and there.
Right, absolutely. But one of the quotes that jumped out at me, and I don't know if it may have come from you, you can confirm or deny that, but the quote was, paradoxically, speaking of George, he became more moody and uptight after he learned to meditate. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
Well, it's sad, but true. I think it made me worry about him because I thought, when he's meditating, he's in another world. It's a very peaceful, calm world of meditation. And then when you come out of it, you have the real world. And I think the two were just fighting against each other in George's mind. He couldn't melt the two together.
Mm-hmm. Because it would seem then the opposite was happening from what was supposed to from the practice of meditating. Instead of being more calm and more peaceful, he gives incidents in his book of George being agitated when, like, for instance, when he was on a plane and a flight attendant interrupted him. Can't you say I'm meditating? Something like that. It just seems sort of paradoxical.
Yeah, it's so weird that he couldn't embrace life and meditation. For me, I can meditate, and then it's lovely when I finish meditating because, I don't know, it just lifts the world. It lifts the clouds in the world somehow. You know, it's more calming. The day is going to be more calm. But George didn't like the day. He preferred to be meditating. I don't know.
Interesting. So it was an escape from the world.
Yeah, he was quite complicated, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were the one that sort of spearheaded the discovery of the Maharishi by attending one of his lectures and then bringing George and then the Beatles falling into it. And this came after their acid experimentation, which you unwittingly, along with George and John and Cynthia, partook when it was slipped to you guys in 65. How did you find that experience, and were you ready to move on by the time you found meditation?
Move on?
Yeah, from LSD.
Well, the first time we had LSD, it was very naughtily dropped into our coffee at a dinner party. And then we maybe had it twice again, or maybe one more time, two or three more times, and that was it. I don't know. It's not something that I wanted to, I don't know. I think it wasn't something that I particularly enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine, you know, as an experience, but it's not something that I personally would ever become addicted to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that sort of drug. I don't know if you've ever taken it. It's just I find it irritating.
Really?
Because it lasts for so long. And quite frankly, I've got lots to do during the day.
Okay.
So to be trapped in this drug is actually really irritating because you can't shake it off. It's boring.
Interesting. Okay. George had said something similar once he'd gotten into TM about it did what it could do for him and now he was done with it. So it's interesting that you both had sort of similar reactions.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's talking about LSD, right?
Yes.
Do you think that with acid, in fact, that what you discover is yourself or just a fantasy?
People can look at themselves objectively, you know, instead of thinking that you're the big cheese, like people
tend to do.
Or even
you're not the big cheese, whatever you think.
Yeah, or whatever you think, you can see yourself from a different point of view. So consequently, it shows you a bit more truth than you've seen. Oh, and of course, truth depends on the person seeing it. But the thing is, you see certain things that have been there all the time, and yet you've lived with such a narrow concept of just general things, just like the trees or the grass or anything.
So presumably, when you gave up those experiments with drugs, it wasn't because you felt you knew everything about yourselves, but because of the disadvantages of the thing as well, wasn't it?
The thing is that your true self isn't on this level. Again, it's on a subtler level. So whatever the true self is, the way to approach it is through meditation or some form of yoga. We're not saying that this meditation is the only answer. It's obviously not. Yoga incorporates lots of different techniques, but the whole point is that each soul is potentially divine.
No, I mean, after transcendental meditation, he then really loved the Hare Krishna movement.
Mm-hmm. Was that something he found on his own, or were you kind of leading the way in that one as well?
No, I think we met some really nice people from the movement, Krishna movement. Really adorable, so nice. And of course, they've got nowhere to live, and we had this huge house and gardens that needed taken care of, and it was all a mess. So we asked two families if they'd like to come live with us. We had plenty of room and their little children. And they would instigate meditation for us, chanting every day, chanting Hare Krishna.
And that was at Friar Park.
That was at Friar Park.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Going back a bit to the Rishikesh experience. Now, you'd already been to India with George in 66 after the end of touring.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Oh, when George and I first went to India, we were guests of Ravi Shankar, the most fantastic man and musician. And he wanted George to learn a little bit about the Indian culture, as he seemed to like playing his sitar or learning sitar. And so Ravi asked us to come over to India and he would take us around, which he did. So we went to see the most beautiful monuments and temples And then we learned how to meditate. We learned yoga. And when Ravi was doing a concert, either private concert or public, we would go along and just, we were just totally taken in, immersed into the whole Indian culture. It was so gentle, so beautiful. And wherever we went, there was a lovely smell of joss-sticks in the air. It was really very spiritual. We loved it, absolutely loved it.
George has described Indian music as something that on some level was familiar. Did it have that same effect on you?
No, I felt that it was very foreign.
Uh-huh.
Very foreign. And within that, it was very exciting. And it also was a mood enhancer as well, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it because it was different. It didn't remind me of anything at all I'd ever heard before.
So the early 1968 trip to Rishikesh, you're all there as couples and this sort of extended entourage, Mal is there and Mia Farrow. What was that like? You guys stayed there along with John and Cynthia the longest. Were you enjoying it or did it turn after a certain point where you're ready to leave?
No, I mean, well, quite frankly, Robert, 2 months is quite a long time. You know,
okay.
No, we absolutely loved it. And on reflection, I think it's the best thing that the Beatles did because one thing, you know, Brian Epstein had died and they needed some time and quiet to mourn Brian's death and to also slowly work out what they were going to do from there, how they were going to move on. So it was perfect timing that the Maharishi invited us all to go there to the ashram. And of course, you know, it gave them lots of uninterrupted time to be creative, write all the songs, virtually all the songs from the White Album. And, you know, when we weren't meditating, nice people to talk to, very nice, interesting people. Plus, we'd go to listen to lectures by Maharishi. So, you know, we were learning, boys were being creative, and it was just enjoyable. But yeah, 2 months, I think it's quite a long time to be away from home and my cats and everything.
Sure.
So, no, it was then it was time to move on, you know. George and I went down to South India because he didn't want to go straight back to London and start talking about business, talking about the offices that they were going to have called Apple. And he wanted to sort of have that middle section between going back to London life.
So had you, in the years since, have you kept up with TM or meditation generally? And have you been back to India?
I've been back to India many times. I love India and I meditate, but I'm a bit of a naughty girl. I don't do it every day. But when I do it, it's just like, oh, yeah, that was wonderful. Why don't I do it more often? And I don't know. I'm so susceptible to things going on and the phone ringing and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I end up being quite busy. And then I think, damn, another day's gone and I haven't meditated.
It's interesting that you describe that as a perfect, wonderful experience for them. As you described, to mourn Brian, to be away, to be creative and to be unencumbered by the normal business of being a Beatle.
Mm.
There's some people who have looked at the experience that they just recorded a few songs before they went. They recorded Lady Madonna. George had done the Wonderwall soundtrack. They tracked Inner Light and Hey Bulldog, Across the Universe. They go to India, go straight into making the White Album, more or less, and the setup of Apple. And people looking from a distance say, the Beatles who went to India were not the same Beatles who came back. Like there was a profound paradigm shift. Is that something you observed or is that something you think is off base?
Well, it's very difficult. You can't really be that definitive simply because now here they were without Big Brother, without Brian Epstein, who they all adored and relied on to guide their careers and guide their lives, really. Brian was all encompassing. He was the most fantastic man. And to lose that person in your life, you have to change, don't you?
Sure.
Because now they've got to learn how to stand on their own 2 feet and be independent. Whereas previously, I think they were more boyish, you know, because they could lean on Brian. Brian could get them in and out of trouble, and he was always fun. But he was like, you know, numero uno for them.
So coming into 68 and the White Album sessions, it seemed to be an unwritten rule up until that time that the women were kept out of the studio when they were working. And then this was John coupling up with Yoko and she's at his side inseparably. But this is also the year where during those sessions, for the second time, because apparently you're on Yellow Submarine as well, as part of the background of the partiers.
Yes, I was.
You actually sing on a Beatle track on birthday, singing backing vocals. Do you remember how that came about?
Yes. That was so fun. That was incredible. I couldn't believe they'd asked me to join them because I cannot sing. But the invitation was too delicious. I had to say yes.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, it was great fun. We did it in a few takes. And it was lovely watching everybody sing at the same time. It was fun rather than a pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to dance,
birthday.
Take a chance,
birthday.
I would like you to dance,
birthday.
Dance, yeah.
Do you remember that evening being at Cavendish and watching The Girl Can't Help It?
No.
It's that early rock and roll film with Little Richard and Gene Vincent, and it's in the Beatle history that because it was appearing on TV that night, everybody wanted to watch it, and then you guys went back to the studio and recorded Birthday. I didn't know if you had any direct recall of that at all.
You know, I don't remember everything. I'm sorry, Robert. It'd be great if I could.
No, I don't blame you. It's unfair of me, but I just didn't know if you had a particular recollection of that.
No, I don't.
All right. Well, scooting forward, I had done the event a couple of years ago where we had some of the people who'd been on the rooftop. Alan Parsons, Kevin Harrington, Chris O'Dell. And in real time, when the question came up, why weren't you there that day? Chris, I guess, texted you and got the response back right away that Georgia told you not to come. Can you elaborate on that? And what was the reasoning? And in hindsight, would you have wanted to have been there?
I would have loved to have gone there. But the reality is, George didn't realize what they were going to be doing. He knew that the Beatles were going to get together and play, but he had no details. He didn't know what was planned. And I said, oh, well, can I come? Because it seems like everyone's going. And he said, no, I think we might have had a little bit of a domestic,
Yeah.
Which happens, happens to everyone.
Yeah, right. That's pretty well documented, what happened then. And without getting too much into the details, you guys were on the outs, but then you reconciled. And have you seen Get Back? The film, the Peter Jackson film?
I saw the bit. Peter Jackson came to London and he created an hour and a half for us all to see.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a premiere event. But I haven't seen the whole thing for hours.
Okay.
No.
The bit I'm talking about was...
Why? Did you like it?
Yeah. I mean, to me, as a fan, I can't get enough of it.
Right.
But it's funny. Everybody I've talked to that was there at the time found it a hard slog. Like, I lived this once. I can't watch it again. So for the fans, it's a great gift. For the people that were there, it's like, nah, we're fine with our memories.
Well, I must say, the way Peter Jackson edited it for, this one night, it was absolutely fantastic. And I had forgotten how hilarious John was.
Mm.
I mean, when I was watching, I was just laughing. He is so funny.
Yeah, I think that was therapeutic for Julian to see as well.
Yeah. I mean, some of it I felt was a little difficult to watch because I could see that George was not happy all the time.
Did you have a sense of that in real time when it was happening?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Because he'd bring it home.
Sure. The bit that I was referring to that I don't know if was part of the cut you saw is after apparently you and George had made up, you stop by Apple Studio and you come into the basement when they're working and give them a kiss and then leave. Do you remember that? Did you see that?
I did see that bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I did see that little bit, yes.
I think it was something that jumped out for the fans.
I thought that was rather nice. It was my film entrance and exit.
Yes.
In a few seconds.
Yeah. And you looked at the camera and said,
prisoners? I didn't.
I know.
That would have been unbelievably stupid.
That's so iconic.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. An unlikely friendship begins in the Paramount Plus original movie, Little Wing, starring Brooklyn Prince with Kelly Riley and Brian Cox. Reeling from her parents' divorce, Caitlin steals a valuable bird to save her home, but instead forms a bond with the owner, leading to a new outlook on life. Little Wing. now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. Head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Rated PG-13.
Did you get a sense beyond the film, but just at that time in general, the ups and downs of married life and all that stuff, but with the Beatles themselves, post Rishikesh, post Brian, did you get a sense of things winding down as it was happening?
Well, that's so difficult to answer. Because you see, they were winding down, but at the same time, George is really excited and eager to get on with his stuff, you know, with all his songs. And he had a big catalogue of songs that he wanted to record and put out. So he was, in a way, irritated with the whole Beatles stuff. It was all really annoying, and there were endless meetings with lawyers, which can drag anyone down.
Sure.
And then the Beatles themselves being a bit nasty to each other, and they were friendly enough. The whole of that time was really a struggle for everyone. And it was sad, you know? It was like a divorce. It was very, very sad.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting in hindsight, because there is the moment in the Get Back film where George floats the idea to John about him getting his backlog of songs out of the way by recording a solo album. And John is very much supporting. It's like, yeah, that'd be a great idea.
Oh.
And you look at it from this distance, you think, well, why didn't he do it? That would have been great. Would have relieved some pressure and maybe made the Beatles a little more palatable for him.
Absolutely. Well, I wonder why he didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I've got so many songs that I've got, like, my quota of tunes for the next 10 years or albums. Yeah. I'd just like to maybe do an album of songs.
Of you, on your own?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'd like it so that if... because it would be nice. It would be nice to mainly to get them all out the way.
Anyway.
And secondly, just to hear what I, all mine are like, all together.
If we put out an LP, it was all safe that the Beatles are together, but George is doing an album.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, it'd be nice to, if so any of us can do separate things as well. But that way, it also preserves the Beatle bit of it more. Because then...
You have outlet for every little note you want.
You know, because all these songs of mine, I could give to people who could do them good, but I suddenly realised, you know, fuck all that. Just gonna do me for a bit. You know?
And especially with having John's backing as well, that's really extraordinary.
Right. And I know that, just from the other people I've talked to, even going into All Things Must Pass, he seemed very insecure about his own worth and his own songs. And maybe that's what stopped him from doing it.
I saw Glyn Johns last year, towards the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that the Beatles were in the studio and Glyn was producing them. And then George was hanging back towards the end and the others all left. And then George said to Glyn, "Glyn, can I play you something that I think might be nice?" So Glyn listened and George played him something. And Glyn said, "That is so beautiful. You have to record it." But you see, it just is indicative of George being really a little insecure or unsure of his own creativity, which is so silly because he was so brilliant. Anyway, that's how he was then.
I've read somebody describe him as an introvert in an extrovert's world. Is that kind of fair?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of fair. You see, we're two. George and I are both Pisces, fishes swimming in different directions.
Yeah.
Right? It's difficult sometimes.
Right.
Difficult to be a Pisces.
Right. And you would say the same of yourself, an introvert in an extrovert's world.
Yes, mm-hmm. I can. Absolutely. I can push myself and go out into an extrovert world, but left to my own devices, I'm rather shy and, you know, quiet.
Never seen such a beautiful girl. Got me shaking inside, calling on me from deep within her eyes. Not the kind you go handing around, wanna keep her right there. But this loving may come as no surprise. And
It has been said by somebody who was around in your circle. I don't want to say who just yet, but March 17th, 1970, your birthday, at Friar Park, a birthday party was held. This would have been very early on, as you know, when you guys were getting in there and it was still not really all set up yet. But that all four Beatles attended your birthday party? Does that ring a bell?
I think they did.
Okay.
I think they did.
It was Chris O'Dell who said this, and I was looking for independent confirmation because if true, that would be the last time we know all four Beatles were together.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
In 1970. Right. Well, maybe they did. I mean, I don't, to be honest, I don't really remember.
Uh-huh.
You see, the thing is, for me, it's quite different because I'm so used to seeing them around.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they did all turn up, it wasn't that big a deal.
It all conflates.
It was just like, oh, great, they're here. How nice.
Right.
But one thing I do feel sad and I'm very, very sad about is that when Eric and I had a wedding party, all the Beatles were there and they played except for John because he couldn't leave America. They wouldn't have let him back in again.
Well, by that time he'd gotten his green card. And maybe you guys didn't know that then because it had been in the news how he was struggling to stay in America. But actually, as of 76, he could travel.
Oh, that's making me feel even worse.
Well, I'm not trying to make you feel worse. I was wondering if there was a particular design because Eric, based on what I know, enjoyed playing with Yoko. He enjoyed the Plastic Ono Band stuff. Is that something you can attest to? Do you have firsthand knowledge of that?
No, no idea.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like he understood. But there are some people say, oh, maybe they didn't want John to bring Yoko for her doing a freak out on stage and nobody wanted that on a wedding celebration. And that's why, pointedly, he wasn't asked.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad everybody's got these ideas about it.
Well, exactly. That's what people do.
Yes.
And I'm glad I could talk to somebody who actually knows something.
Yeah.
What was interesting in the auction holdings, you have that letter from John, June 25th, 73. As you had said, watching Get Back and being reminded of his humor, that's what jumped off the page in this letter, just the wordplay. It's something that was never made public before. And I thought that was a really cool thing to see as a fan, John communicating with you guys in 1973, sort of the old John, that guy that we knew from In His Own Right.
Oh, God, that letter is so hilarious. I think it's wonderful. And then all the different names at the bottom, they are real people, but he's mixed their names around.
Right. It's becoming kind of a game now for the fans to decipher who he's referring to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I may have to ask you back about that.
But he is so funny. Mm-hmm. Really funny. Yeah.
Patty had a career.
She's given her career up, hasn't she?
Well, not really for a time being, but she's never became a housewife. I mean, Patty just big enough to decide when she works and to do special things like all top models do, and that's the position she's in. Not because she gave up her work to become a housewife. You won't see Patty washing dishes. Mm. I mean, she will wash a dish, but she has a career of her own.
What was the happiest time, looking back, on all the incredible stuff you saw in such a compact period during the Beatle years and even beyond? Is there a point in your life, looking back at this distance and with maturity, that you think, boy, that was the greatest time?
Well, without thinking about it too deeply, I really, really loved a trip that John and Cynthia, George and I made when we went to Tahiti and then sailed around the Polynesian islands. It was so glorious and fun. And John and George were really funny together. And Cynthia and I had a great time. It was the most beautiful experience. Beautiful. On a lovely old wooden boat. And the captain of the boat every morning would dive off with his spear gun in and spear some fish. And that would be lunch. It was really simple, clean living. It was glorious.
And that was before you and George were married. It was during the height of Beatlemania, but before 66, right?
I have no idea what year it was.
Okay. I think I've seen pictures and I've read about it. But yeah, interesting. That's great.
That was lovely.
Is there anything, looking back, you wish you could have done differently along the way?
Mm. That's difficult, you see, because I would be a different person if I'd done it differently.
Okay. You turned out all right.
Yeah.
You had no designs for this grand career or notoriety or celebrity or any of that stuff. You were getting on with it. You were doing a job. You were having fun with it. And then you got, whether destiny, fate, law of attraction, whatever, got pulled into the Beatles world and fell in love with a Beatle. So you're at the right place at the right moment in history amidst what nowadays are called influencers, the Beatles, having that kind of impact. You had an amazing amount of power. All these fans that see you and look up to you, if they're girls, they're identifying with you and aspiring to be you. But you've got the Beatles' ear, and you take this power. You get drawn into meditation. You bring it to George. George brings it to the Beatles. The Beatles bring it to the Western world. So you had this amazing platform of influence, and you used it for positivity. You brought something profound to Western culture that resonates to this very day. Maybe they would have found it on their own eventually, but there was no greater engine than the Beatles with all that light and power focused on them at that time. And you undeniably, indisputably, were the prime mover for that. Is that something you've ever thought about? Because you look at all the people that do yoga now and are into meditation now. That stemmed from you, I would make that argument. And what a force for good to put into the world. You had that power. You could have gone any other way, but that's what you did with it. Is that something you think about?
I don't think about it. Well, if I do have a moment, I think how fantastic it was that I was introduced to meditation at that time in history. And the power and the rays of energy that has emanated from that one movement of all of us going to India, and all the people that have been affected by learning how to meditate, and how it's healed so many people. And people have become aware, simply because of the Beatles, of something like meditation, which Maharishi always said, everyone should do it, everybody should do it. And it would strengthen the world, strengthen positivity and peace. I mean, obviously not everyone's doing it at the moment. It's all chaotic out there. But, you know, I love it. I love to hear that people are still meditating. And I'm glad that we sort of initiated that move, that movement. You know, it was, I must say, Robert, I can't claim any applause for this, because I do believe if something happens, it's meant to happen. And in this instance, it happened through me because I made that initial move and then told George about it and then Paul did, and then we all joined in. But it was going to come to us anyway. But I think how fabulous that we were invited to India and the world was looking on and thought that they would like to learn how to meditate too. It's positive. It's good. It's good for everyone.
What more can you ask for? Brilliant. Is there any particular songs? Now, George started becoming a songwriter really in earnest after you met him and were together with him. He had done the one song for the second album, Don't Bother Me, but he started really practicing his craft and really developed so quickly. Are there any particular favorite songs of his that you witnessed the creation of along the way?
My Sweet Lord. Definitely. I remember that so clearly. And While My Guitar Gently Weeps, I love that. It's just so fabulous. I think that, you know, he probably bottled up a lot of his musical creative energy while he was in the studio with Paul and Ringo and John, when he wasn't able to play his songs. Maybe out of his own insecurity, I don't know. But it was all probably good for him, because when he did, he burst out. And all this wonderful music came out of him that had probably been brewing up for some time.
Right, right. Did you get a sense when being around them? You've described socially how much fun you had around the Beatles, but George has described being Beatles second class along with Ringo, and that maybe not being taken as seriously in the studio as they thought they deserved. Did you experience that or hear of that in real time?
No, I felt a little upset with George because I realized that he couldn't really push in when John and Paul were being very creative and they were writing all the music. It was all theirs. There was no little opening for George. Really annoying for him.
Right.
But, you know, he was very cool. I think he knew his day would come.
Mm-hmm. And it is amazing when we find out more and more through the years of the key components he contributed to Lennon-McCartney songs that made them amazing.
Absolutely. Of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, those four people in the studio together and with a producer like George Martin or Glyn, you know, what a team. What an incredibly creative team.
It seems miraculous, doesn't it?
Mm, it does, yeah.
The right people found each other.
Absolutely. All meant to be, I think.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. One last thing. Are you really sick of the word muse now?
Muse.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, I can't claim any of that. For me, a muse is somebody who's being painted by a wonderful artist. It's a muse, an inspiration and a muse. So I don't really think of it in this modern terminology. I think a muse is happening in like 1900s, you know, I mean, years and years ago. But I suppose that is the word that's put on to somebody that encourages, you know, a muse sort of encourages the artist, brings out the artist's creativity and helps with that. I don't know if I can say I am, but maybe I am. Maybe I should acknowledge, bow down with thanks.
It's a good way to put it. I found it interesting that beyond the obvious ones, the George and Eric songs, there was that song by Ashton, Gardner, and Dyke.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one most people don't know about.
You're the first person that's mentioned that. I've never dared talk about it before. Yeah.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, executive producer Rick Way, title song performed by the Corgis.
Something to my soul. She makes me laugh, makes me smile. She makes me lose control. There's something about her, and I can't live without her. My mind will indefinitely blow. Sweet Patsy O'Hara-Smith, my mind will indefinitely blow. Sweet Patsy O'Hara-Smith turns me inside out, makes me scream, she makes me steam, makes me jump and shout. There's something about her, and I can't live without her. Definitely freaking me out. Sweet Patsy O'Hara-Smith, definitely freaking me out. Definitely freaking me out. Sweet Patsy O'Hara-Smith belongs to my best friend. But he's so tired, it just ain't right. He won't even give me a lend. But I'm gonna get her, and I'd like to bet her she'll come round to me in the end. Sweet Patsy O'Hara Smith, she's driving me right round the bend. Yeah, she's driving me right round the bend.